evening, everyone, and welcome. My name is Michelle Lamont McIntyre. I'm the Community Services Librarian here at the library. And on behalf of the staff and trustees, I'd like to welcome you to this evening's program, which is Great Fires of the American Revolution with Mr. John Horrigan. Before I introduce Mr. Horrigan, I just have a few announcements to make. I'd like to thank the Friends of the Framingham Library for supporting this program in part and for all of their support throughout the year in terms of supporting our programming, resources, museum passes, DVDs, etc. We are really in need of the community's help from this point forward. The library is really hurting for funding to be able to continue to provide the kinds of services, programs, and things that the community has come to expect. So the way that you can best support the library is by supporting the Friends of the Framingham Library, either by joining it, which is a very nominal, really, fee to join, but it goes a long way towards supporting the Friends. You can do any of their fundraisers that we have a couple going on right now. One is with TD Bank North, and the other is with Shaw's Supermarkets. And also by attending and purchasing books at their book sale, which happen 10 months out of the year, and we have an ongoing book sale room that is directly across from the circulation desk. And all of those proceeds go back to the library. And with funding being cut from the state down to the town level, we're going to look to the community to support us even more as we go through the next couple of years. I'd also like to thank Trader Joe's in Framingham for providing refreshments for tonight's program and for their ongoing generosity. They've been actively providing refreshments for at least a couple of programs a month, and that really helps us to stretch our program dollars. And so if you're ever in the store, please go up to the captain's desk and thank them for their generosity and their support of your public library. We also have a great number of programs coming up. Next Wednesday, up-and-coming author Emily Arsenault will be here to talk about her new novel, The Broken Tea Glass, and Borders will be on hand to sell copies of her book at a 20% discount. On Friday, March 5th, we will screen Bright Star for our Friday night film. And on Saturday, we are really excited about a program that we're offering a week from this Saturday, March 6th. It's our first ever day of lifelong learning, and the program will be, it's called Day of Discovery, Exploring 1910. And we'll have lectures in the morning on art history and history of the time. We have a donated luncheon from Somerville at Farm Pond and a traveling musician. And then in the afternoon, it'll conclude with a performance of hot jazz by a duo called John Clark and Henry Thins Francis. So we're hoping that you can join us for that. That's a sign-up event. If you are interested in signing up, or if you know people who are, there are flyers at the back of the room, and I can help you sign up at the end of the program if you're interested. And now it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker this evening, Mr. John Horrigan. John, when I was looking at his website today, I realized is truly a Renaissance man. He is a folklorist, a project manager, a paranormal expert, a professional announcer, and a reenactor, as well as being very interested in meteorology, and recently, within the last couple of years, did a program on that. Tonight, he's here to speak about Great Fires of the American Revolution. Please join me in welcoming Mr. John Horrigan.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction, Michelle. Some people can call me a Renaissance man, or my wife. She calls me scattered. In fact, when we got married, she said, when I married you, I didn't realize that four of your other personalities were waiting for you down in our car. Well, tonight's talk is about great fires of the American Revolution. I'm not going to go over that. I'm into fire researches, historical astronomy, historical weather, historical economy. I'm also a reenactor with the Lincoln Minutemen. And I'm a professional sports announcer, so I apologize in advance if it sounds like a hockey game. I announce hockey for the Boston Bruins alumni. I've been with them 18 years. And I'm the New England Patriots basketball announcer, but that's another story on another day. And I invite you at the bottom graphic there to the New England History Festival held in Watertown, our fourth annual Historapalooza, a colonial Woodstock. That's on November 13th. 2010historyfestival.org. My website, ushistory.me, although I checked it about an hour ago, it's down. You can join my meetup group at meetup.com, New England History Group. My historical audio archive, I've got 1,000 recordings there. Contact me through johnhorrigan@hotmail.com. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention fire exits right out the door, and then take a left and go away from the building. Tonight's lecture is text-driven. I will, trust me, they'll be able to hear me in Natick tonight, but I'm going to drive the text off the screen. There are only a limited amount of photographs, wink, wink, available from the American Revolution. But tonight, we're going to talk about the fire of the colonies, early fires of the Revolution, fires that sparked the American Revolution, major fires of the American Revolution, other great fires of the Revolution, a dark day, and a traitor returns. The fire of the colony. Do you mind if I lose my tricorn here? This is not a wardrobe malfunction. I'm just going to lose the musket box and this linen jacket here. But fire of the colonies tonight. Well, we're going to talk about fire for survival, fire as a farming tool, fire as a siege weapon, fire as a foe, and fire as propaganda, and also colonial firefighting. Well, fire for survival. It's a primary energy source, and it's utilized for cooking, heat, light, and energy. Home is where the hearth is. The fireplace was central to home and family life, and the fire was part of the family and demanded attention like a small child. Survival was dependent upon maintaining warmth and staying dry. Wood, whale oil, and coal were the cores of a consistent fire. Wood stocks had to be managed effectively. Fire safety and precautionary measures like ventilation, disposal of embers, were inherent to any household. It was also used as a farming tool in slash and burn agriculture. You had to clear land for farming. In autumn, you'd chop the trees halfway down at waist level. You'd topple them onto one another in a domino effect, and then you'd burn it in late spring. You had two benefits. One was clearing the land, and number two, the ash was great fertilizer. This caused a dark day in New England on May 19, 1780. We're going to talk about that later. And most land in 17th century New England was covered by forest. Today, slash and burn is destroying most of the Amazon and the tropical rainforests of Indonesia, which are considered the lungs of earth. Fire as a siege weapon. Well, it was the first terror weapon used. It was utilized as an offensive weapon. During the siege of Syracuse, Archimedes allegedly used a burning glass to set the Roman warships afire. The Romans used trebuchets to fling fire gobs at fortresses. Invading armies would burn villages to the ground. Fire rafts were used in the War of 1812 and in the Revolutionary War. And allies used incendiary bombs on Japan and Germany, or as a defensive measure. Washington and Alexander the Great used dummy campfires to conceal their nighttime maneuvers. Moscow was set ablaze by its residents to foil Napoleon. And you're going to see that coming up in our talk here. And then the Iraqi Republican Guard, of course, set their oil wells afire. What about fire as a foe, whether it's accidental or natural? Lightning. Lightning is still the major cause of forest fires. Also carelessness in discarding cigarettes, unattended campfires, wafting sparks, and electrical fires caused by electrical heaters and old wiring. That's my Smokey the Bear talk for you tonight. Also, instantaneous ignition. Jamestown, John Smith in 1608. Ironically, smoking was only permitted indoors. And that's because wind rather than carelessness was the culprit of most early American fires. Aside from disease, the biggest killer in a village was a floating ember that was fanned to flame. A village could be reduced to ash with one errant spark. A thatched roof on a wooden house was a fuse waiting to be lit. Of course, when you talk about building codes and zoning laws, there was a lack of regulation. There was an absence of building codes, and consequently, structures were built with flammable components like straw and dried wood. There were no zoning laws, and therefore houses and buildings, especially in cities, could be built almost on top of one another. And regulations would only be instituted after a terrible fire had taken place. The first great fire in Boston was 1676. And of course, fire can be used as propaganda if you destroy something symbolically. Hard to believe this was only 70 years ago. Everyone enjoys a nice book burning. Bonfires emphasized a political stance. Nazi book burnings were the only social outlets. Gletel, would you like to accompany me and Hans to the book burning tonight? Colonists burn an effigy of tea stocks. You're going to see that tonight. And then attacking armies, of course, would set villages ablaze. So immediate reaction to the alarm is essential. And the speed was the key to fighting fires in early America. All must answer the bell. There was no traditional organized firefighting units or modern apparatus. Some village ordinances decreed that each household must possess a bucket, a ladder, a long pole with a swab, and a broom. All males must respond to the ringing of the church bell. The bucket brigade would form at the well and stretch towards the inferno. Let's look at some early fires of the American Revolution. We'll look at the Stamp Act effigies, the false alarm gone bad, great tea burnings. The Stamp Act, August 14, 1765. The Stamp Act of 1765 was a tax imposed by the Parliament on the colonies to help pay for troops stationed in North America following the British victory in the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War. August 14, 1765, Andrew Oliver, a distributor of stamps from Massachusetts, was hung in effigy from a giant elm tree at the crossings of Essex and Orange Streets in the city's south end. The sheriff is ordered by Lieutenant Governor Thomas Hutchinson to take the effigy down, but he was opposed by a large crowd who detoured merchants on Orange Street to have their goods symbolically stamped under the elm tree, later known as the Liberty Tree. At night, a mob led by Ebenezer McIntosh cut down the effigy and took it in a funeral procession to the townhouse where the legislature met. Then they went to Oliver's office, tore it down, and then took the effigy to Oliver's home, where they beheaded and burned the effigy, along with Oliver's stable house and coach and chaise. Sheriff and Hutchinson were then stoned when they tried to stop the mob, which then proceeded to loot and destroy the contents of Oliver's house. October 24, 1765. The stamps for several of the northern colonies arrive in New York Harbor. Placards are posted that say, "The first man that either distributes or makes use of stamp paper, let him take care of his house, person, and effects." We burn it down. There was a boycott of English goods until the act was repealed. And unruly mobs took to the streets for 4 days of demonstrations. In fact, 2,000 people attacked Governor Colden's home and burned two sleighs and a coach. Now we all know about this one. March 5th, 1770. 11 shot, 5 dead in the Boston Massacre. Well, the ringing of the bells, citizens supposed that a fire was in progress on King Street. And they brought ye buckets, and they saw the mob near the old State House. Incidentally, do you see that phantom musket?
The phantom shot.
Coming from a window. Of course, 5 dead. Has anybody here seen the series John Adams?
Nope.
I recommend it highly. They do take liberties, like when the Knox Cannon train goes by the Adams house. It did not, but they do a marvelous job acting. But in the opening scene, as Adams is called because he hears the church bell, he hears fire, so he grabs the bucket, and the mob is yelling fire. At the British soldiers, you know, trying to challenge them to fire into the crowd, which they did after somebody picked up a chunk of ice and hit a British soldier off the noggin. But that's an 18th century fire bucket, leather. And we're going to be talking about that later. Well, December 16, 1773, the Boston Tea Party takes place. No fire involved here, but other tea parties follow, and some precede it. May 10, 1773. To keep the troubled East India Company afloat, Parliament passes the Tea Act, taxing all tea in the American colonies. In Lexington, a few days prior to the Boston Tea Party, or Tea Raid as it was called, the inhabitants met and resolved not to use tea of any sort, no matter where it had come from, and to show their sincerity, they brought together every ounce contained in the town and committed it to one common bonfire. The Annapolis Tea Party. Incidentally, this is a tea chest that washed ashore after the Boston Tea Party in Dorchester in 1773, and it was found in an attic just a few years ago. Some debate its authenticity to the actual Tea Party. October 14, 1774, an action similar to Boston's Tea Party. The British East India Company tea ship anchored at Annapolis, called the Peggy Stewart, is loaded with more than a ton of smuggled British tea in packages labeled as linen. Well, men approached the ship owner, a Mr. Stewart, and told him to sign a paper stating that he had done wrong in bringing British tea into the colony and that he would destroy his tea. Mr. Stewart was scared of the men, and instead of burning the tea, he burned his whole ship. Something known as the Second Boston Tea Party took place on March 7, 1774. Colonel Knowles confronted his eastern neighbors. It was a day that Governor Hutchinson proclaimed a day of public fasting. Well, a band of men, evidently believing that they had located some of the tea from the tea ship William that remained, entered the Boston shop of a tea merchant known as Davison, Newman & Company, whose tea had been destroyed in the Boston Tea Party. And they took 16 chests of tea down to the harbor, broke them open, and dumped the contents into the water. And this act has been referred to as the Second Boston Tea Party. No fire involved, but I thought it was interesting. But the Princeton Tea Party. It's late January 1774, and one night at Princeton College, their students from all the colonies broke into the college's storeroom. Described by student Charles Beatty, quote, "We gathered all the steward's winter store of tea, and having made a fire on the campus, we there burned near a dozen pound, tolled the bell, and made many spirited resolves. They also made an effigy of Massachusetts Governor Hutchinson, tied a tea canister around his neck, and burned it in front of Nassau Hall." Hutchinson was burned quite a few times in effigy. The students subsequently continued their agitations, including paying nocturnal visits in groups of 40, dressed in white, to local townspeople rumored to be tea drinkers, seizing their stock of tea and burning it. The Greenwich Tea Party. Summer 1774. Captain of the small ship Greyhound is loaded with East India Company tea, and he was reluctant to try to unload his shipment in Philadelphia. Well, just before the Delaware Bay, he put into Cohansey Creek, and he anchored at the little hamlet of Greenwich, New Jersey. There he unloaded his cargo, and it was put into the cellar of a loyalist, Daniel Bowen, who intended to have it eventually carried overland into Philadelphia and to sell it there. Well, on the night of December 22, 1774, after planning in secret for several months, 40 locals dressed as Indians broke into Bowen's house, carried the cases of tea into a field, dumped the tea in a large pile, and set it on fire. Those who participated in this tea party were arrested, but were not convicted because the jury was in complete sympathy with them. I spent summers in Marshfield, and this is known as the Marshfield Tea Party. December 19, 1773. After the Boston Tea Party, the patriots of Marshfield learned that there was a large quantity of tea secreted by some authorities in the cellar of a house called the Ordinary, 200 or 300 feet from the street leading from the First Congregational Church. The Marshfield patriots marched to the house and demanded the tea. Resistance being useless, it was given up and carried to a rock on a hill directly not far from the First Congregational Church. It was heaped upon a huge rock, now known as Tea Rock, and it was burned to ashes. The Ordinary was constructed as a tavern in 1673 and still is located at 2000 Ocean Street at the corner with Moraine Street. In 1773, that building was owned by John Bourne. Well, anyways, after taking the tea, the patriots knelt in prayer and ceremoniously burnt the tea on a large rock situated on what became known as Tea Rock Hill. Let's look at some early Boston fires of the Revolution. Now, I could put up 24 fires here tonight. I've just selected a couple. In 1772, in April, a fire in a British coffee house breaks out on King Street. And again, I'm pulling fires that are relative to the American-British conflict. On Sunday, April 4th, 1773, a fire originated in the cabinet shop of Mr. Alexander Edwards, located near the Mill Pond. And remember, in those days, Boston was on a peninsula. It looked like a lollipop on an isthmus. And then was filled in later when they chopped off Beacon Hill, and part of the remnants from the Great Fire of 1872 were dumped into the harbor and they built on that. That's why some seismologists think that if an earthquake strikes New England, as it did in 1744, 1755 were the last major ones, that you get quite some shaking there. Anyways, six or seven other buildings were destroyed by this fire, including the first church built by the Scandinavians that stood at the foot of the lane. This is from the history of the Boston Fire Department, August 10th, 1774. It's one of the most terrible fires that occurred on Wednesday, August 10th. This was known as the Eighth Great Fire of Boston because the fire of 1760 that burned Faneuil Hall, where the blaze and the smoke, the glow could be seen from Dedham, Mass., that was known as the Tenth Great Fire. And it occurs on Wednesday, August 10th at about 10:30 at night. The fire is discovered in a large brick dwelling house located on Fish Street at the foot of North Square, which is now the corner of North and Fleet Streets. And it's owned by a Mr. Milliken and Mrs. Campbell. The lower part of the house was a mass of flames before the occupants of the upper floor were aware of their terrible danger. Several escaped by jumping from the windows, some of whom, being considerably burned, were destitute of clothing, while three women and two children perished in the flames. The house was entirely consumed, and a bakehouse adjoining it was badly burned. Now, there's some anti-British sentiment in Boston at this time, and Hugh Earl Percy, one of the commanding officers in Boston, politely offered the service of some soldiers who could be depended upon, but was informed that the regulations of the town rendered their assistance unnecessary. Of course, Engine 3 was the first to throw water on the fire. That's an early Honeyman engine. May 17, 1775, a fire broke out on the south side of the town dock in the building occupied as barracks by the British troops. One of these buildings belonged to John Hancock. For 10 days prior to this fire, there had been a report circulated that the Liberty Party intended to fire the town. Quote, "Soon as I observed the fire," says a Bostonian, "the bell's not ringing, I cried fire, but was stopped by a soldier who said it was against orders and who threatened to knock my brains out if I did not keep still. When I arrived at the fire, there was no engine, and I asked the reason of such extraordinary delay and was told by an engine man that he had been to his engine, but the bayonets were too thick." British holding muskets. After the fire had been long raging, the engines finally arrived. 20,000 pounds worth of damage and a large quantity of provisions generously contributed by the patriotic friends of Boston for the relief of the inhabitants. And Boston was blockaded at that point. They were laboring under the oppressive port bill, and they were also destroyed. So some valuable things, they think the British set that. Even though the Liberty Party had threatened to burn the town down, they think it was set by British troops. Anyways, this conflagration originated from the bursting of some cartridges, and before the fire was extinguished, 30 buildings were destroyed. Another Boston fire, a couple of them. December 3rd, 1777, a fire at Wings Lane on Elm Street. December 11th, the barracks located on Cobble Hill were burned by the British prisoners who were confined there. And for the fire of January 1778, a fire consumed an edifice located in Frog Lane, that's today's Boylston Street, built 50 years earlier by Peter Clarendon, you're familiar with that name, but then occupied by John Carter, Esquire. The fire originated in one of the chambers about 9 o'clock on the evening of the 15th and burnt so rapidly that very little of the furniture was saved. A barn on the premises was also destroyed, and had it not been that the snow was very deep in the roofs of these houses, a terrible conflagration would have resulted. As it was, the several buildings caught, but the flames were extinguished before much damage was done. And then finally, a fire occurred at Mr. Riley's store on August 21st, 1783. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. It broke out in a barn occupied by a Mr. Crane near Oliver's Dock. The flames communicated to five other barns lying in its course, also the dwelling of Mr. Jeremiah Russell and the store of Honorable William Phillips, which were totally destroyed. Nine horses and a large quantity of merchandise were burned. The engine from Roxbury rendered assistance. Two men, one named Moses Haley, having just arrived in town from Hanover, were, with their wives, passing the ruins when a chimney fell, burying the two men, killing Mr. Haley instantly. The other died the next day. During the fire, several men were caught trying to break into the store of William Foster. It was therefore supposed that the fire was of incendiary origin. Another fire was discovered the same day in the cellar of Mr. Townsend, a carpenter, located near the old state house, but was extinguished without much damage. And now, fires that sparked the revolution, the Lexington burnout, the Punkatasset smoke pall, the raising of Charlestown, and the demolition of Boston Light. Of all the available resources, I've selected these books by my good friend Mike Ryan, Conquered on the Dawn of the Revolution, and The Boston Campaign, a marvelous book by Victor Brooks. I'm not going to be talking about maneuvers tonight, folklore, or casualties for the most part. Well, there's the route. Route taken by the British on April 19, 1775, as they left Boston. The whole world knew they were coming. And I'm going to show you four Amos Doolittle plates. This is plate number one that shows the Battle of Lexington on dawn, April 19, 1775, that sparked the revolution. Plate number two, this is a view of the town of Concord. Major Pitcairn and Lieutenant Colonel Francis Smith reconnoiter from Concord's Hilltop Cemetery, making observations. And now the Punkatasset smoke pall. After Samuel Prescott warned the town of Concord of the incurring British regulars, church bells rang out after midnight. At dawn in Concord, Colonel James Barrett returns to his farm uncontested to warn his family that the British are coming to search his property, so they bury munitions in his fields with his sons, and then he returns to the impending confrontation. Well, hundreds of Minutemen and residents are gathered in town and march towards the column of about 700 British soldiers. And upon sighting the advanced force, Colonel James Barrett leads his militia on a retreat to the town's burying ground, then to a place east of the Concord River called Ripley Hill. As he saw that his troops' flanks were exposed, he then led them on to neighboring Punkatasset Hill on the west side of the river and less than a mile from the Old North Bridge to gather strength. Approximately 500 militiamen are there now. The time is right around 9 in the morning on April 19th. There were two British objectives that day: destroy weapons cache and eat breakfast. General Gage's spies had made maps that pointed out several locations of munitions, including 14 cannons. Homes were searched for weapons, and food was purchased. That's almost like Monty Python, I'll pay you on Tuesday, the old wimpy thing. They take food and they'd send you money later, which they never did. Three 24-pound cannons, these are big ones, were dug up from Ephraim Jones Tavern's backyard. The Brits chopped down the town's liberty pole and put it into a pile. Then they started a bonfire. Sparks from the bonfire ignited the town's meeting house. Temporarily, redcoats and residents worked together to extinguish the fire. According to a British historian, quote, "The grenadiers spoiled some flour, knocked the trunnions off several iron guns, burned a heap of wooden spoons, and cut down the liberty pole." That's it. What did they miss? Well, they missed 10 tons of musket balls and cartridges, 50 reams of cartridge paper, 31 flour barrels, over 17 tons of rice, and over 8 tons of dried fish that were scattered throughout the towns of Middlesex County, with significant quantities stored at Barrett's farm. So already, the British operation is a complete failure. So Colonel Barrett, seeing smoke, now moves his militia 1,000 yards closer to the town's muster field, which is a flat hilltop. As a darker smoke pall rose from Concord Center, Adjutant Lieutenant Joseph Hosmer cried, "Will you let them burn the town down?" This, to me, is a very pivotal point in the revolution. I wonder what would have happened had he not said that and had the British not created this dark and billowing smoke pall. I wonder if the militiamen would have been content thumbing their nose at the regulars, even though they had heard about the incident in Lexington in the morning, let them march through town and march back, and perhaps have confronted them later on that day, the following week, maybe a firefight on Boston Common. Crucial moment in the American Revolution right there. After hearing this, Captains William Smith, Billy Smith of Lincoln, and Isaac Davis of Acton then pleaded with Barrett for a forward advance. "We got to go." Barrett relented. He formed up two regiments, had them load up their muskets, and shouted that his troops would not be the first to fire, but if the British fire first, then fire as fast as you can. As the fifers and drummers played the white cockade, Lieutenant Colonel John Robinson and Major John Buttrick led the regiments down the hill toward the Old North Bridge. Upon seeing this rush, the British fall back to the far side of the river, and they curiously begin to pull up planks on the Old North Bridge. They're already retreating. The primary objective for their mission is now forsaken. And of course, they tell me that there's a little gunfight there. I'll tell you a quick story. As a reenactor with the Lincoln Minutemen, and I'm a duffer, I'm known as a good dyer. If your musket jams, you must die. I die all the time. So they mixed my unit with a bunch of other Concord, Sudbury, Billerica. And I found myself in what was told to me to be the slot. I'm on the outside right in the front column. The new captain put me there. So we marched over the bridge because we know the British are coming up behind. And I turned around and I'm in the slot. And here come the British up there. And I'm looking at the British and I'm saying, this is cool, all the red coats. And then they kneel down. Yeah. And then they point their musket at me. And I'm thinking, don't point your musket at me. And then it hit me. I was scared. I flashed back to that day, and I realized I was going to be the first to die. Click, my musket jams, and I fell over. A surreal moment in reenacting for me. Oops, I want to go back. This is plate number 3. This is the engagement at the North Bridge in Concord. As you can see, colonists marched over, formed up over here. So the retreat from Concord and Lexington. British ranking officers Colonel Francis Smith has a leg wound, and Major John Pitcairn has been thrown from his horse and he's injured. The command is in disarray, the orders are unclear, and there's a deadly colonial fusillade upon them. Brigadier Hugh Earl Percy, remember the guy earlier in the talk about who offered assistance to put out a fire? Well, he finally arrives with an elite force, a relief column including 2 6-pound field cannons of reinforcements, over 1,000 men, and 3 regiments of foot. Another dying story, quickly. The Battle of Tower Park, last April, I died first. I had a spectacular fall. I separated my shoulder, but they bring the cannons up. Oh, my, the din that these cannons, they shook the ground. I'm lying there as they were firing these cannons. My word, loud, the concussion. Well, Percy takes Monroe Tavern as a temporary headquarters. They recover Smith's exhausted vanguard in total disarray. Provincial marksmen now took up positions in the tree line and behind any natural cover. They pour sniper fire indiscriminately onto the massing British forces. We didn't play by the rules. Well, Percy orders gunners to destroy any homes or buildings suspected of housing these snipers. And the town's meeting house and several area homes are pounded by cannon. The Bond's house and barn, Loring's house, that's a familiar name in Framingham, Deacon's house, Clockmaker Mulliken's house, and a workshop containing all of his tools are set alight. I think 6 buildings were burned in total. I've seen 7 someplace, but I'm relying on the data that I got from the Mass Historical Society. And now I call this the Lexington burnout. And you can see the smoke rising along the path there and the house to the right side on fire. During this covering action, the soldiers of foot set barns and hay piles ablaze. They used the smoke haze to maneuver in and reposition 2 key offensive points to bolster their salient defenses. The British, who had their ammo wagons lagging behind, and Gage's newly issued ammo wagons being captured in West Cambridge earlier that day, are now running out of ammunition. The situation is critical. Without giving a minute-by-minute detail, there are experts in this room, I'm sure, who can provide further clarity and detail on this battle. The British broke out in a run and were harassed all the way back to Boston and Charlestown. There's a color of that. You can see the house, the fires raging on the right-hand side of that Alonzo Chapel. And of course, it's reported in the British newspapers because a lot of these British soldiers were of Irish origin and they're called Wild Irish Asses Defeated by the Brave American Militia. And that one in the paper back home. And then the fourth plate is the Amos Doolittle abuse of the south part of Lexington, showing the Lexington burnout. Now, Great American Fires of the Revolution, one of my favorite. I got to camp on this island last summer. Remember the summer we had the 10 days in late August? May 21st, 1775. This is, by the way, this island sits off the coast of Hull. Okay, if you look at Howe's Neck, it just sits there. It's really not a Boston Harbor Island. It's a Weymouth Hingham Harbor Island. Hull Harbor. Following the devastating battles at Lexington and Concord, the beleaguered British troops and their sympathizers found themselves under siege and holed up on the peninsula of Boston. In desperate need of supplies and with land routes cut off, the British set their sights on the farms of the Boston Harbor Islands. They could get to them by ship, which remained readily available to them as their naval supremacy remained intact. A small British force set out in 4 boats for the island with the hopes of seizing cattle, vegetables, and hay for horses and livestock. Grape Island was owned by Alicia Levitt, a loyalist living in Hingham. Levitt offered up his farm's provisions to the British Army, thereby becoming, in the eyes of his Patriot neighbors, a turncoat for the Redcoats. Wild rumors quickly spread that the Redcoats were launching an attack on Hingham, Weymouth, or another neighboring town. General alarms began to sound. Bells pealed and guns fired to rouse the militia. A small British force set out in four boats for the island with the hopes of seizing cattle, vegetable, and hay for horses. Abigail Adams was also a witness to these frantic events on the morning of the Grape Island alarm. When she found, quote, "I found the whole town in confusion." And in a letter to her husband John, she wrote, "The report was that 300 had landed and were upon their march into town. The alarm flew like lightning, and men from all parts came flocking down until 2,000 were collected." This was serious business. When the Patriots finally arrived at Weymouth Neck, they discovered the British weren't attempting a land invasion as feared, but loading their boats with hay from Levitt's farm across the channel. The good news for the revolutionaries was that the British force was much smaller than was originally reported. The bad news was that the militia had arrived at low tide and was forced to wait until the flats were covered by the flood tide in order to launch boats to the island. For hours, the colonists watched anxiously as the British made the long trip from barn to boat and back again, carting Levitt's hay as they went. To make matters more vexing, the distance across the water was too great for the militia's small arms to be of any use, though they fired in vain anyway. The British vessels returned fire. Finally, the tide was high enough for the colonists to attack, but no sooner had the Americans launched their boats than the British returned to their ships and set sail for Boston with the few tons of hay that they had removed. The colonists, exchanging fire with the retreating redcoats, landed on Grape Island and proceeded to burn Levitt's barn to the ground, along with its remaining 70 to 80 tons of hay. That's a lot of hay. Levitt's cattle were spared, but relocated to the mainland. They were taken. Amazingly, there were no casualties. And now, the burning of Charlestown. June 17, 1775. The HMS Falcon, Symmetry, Somerset, Glasgow, and Lively, which had 78 guns, roll quietly in the water as shovels, picks, and spades are at work creating a redoubt atop Breed's Hill. At around 4:35 a.m., a lookout aboard HMS Lively spotted the entrenchments, quote, "full of the heads of men who were not British." The ship's master, Thomas Bishop, immediately gives command to bombard the breastworks. Word is sent to Admiral Graves, who orders an immediate ceasefire. After viewing the bulwarks through a spyglass from the Christchurch steeple, General Gage has the orders countermanded and reissues the orders to bombard the fortification. Shots ring out, and the Battle of Breed's Hill begins. Meanwhile, over in Charlestown, General William Howe, in his blood-stained uniform and his personal staff wiped out, gives a controversial order. This order helps Lieutenant Colonel Pigott on the left wing with his grand assault. When 38 companies under Lieutenant Colonel Robert Pigott were assembling for their role as the left wing in the grand assault, they came under a hellacious crossfire from three colonial militias deployed in abandoned buildings in Charlestown, acting as a screen for Colonel William Prescott's garrison. Charlestown, it's called the Neck, population had been reduced by 50%, down from 4,000 people before April 19th to 2,000 after April 19th. As many chose to flee Charlestown as the British had retreated there to Boston and the surrounding countryside with their valuables. Howe commands Admiral Thomas Graves to unleash a naval barrage upon the Neck to dislodge the contingent of colonial harassers. Graves asked Howe if he could use incendiary ammunition. Howe did not object. Pigott also wanted to start a house-to-house search for the militia and then torch those houses. Graves gave the approval. Graves sent word to the British fleet to open up on Charlestown with some hot shot. Now, hot shot refers to heated, red-hot cannonballs or carcasses, which are hollow cannonballs filled with burning pitch. A party of Royal Marines from HMS Somerset then sprints onto the eastern section of the Neck and sets fire to buildings that were not hit by the ship bombardment. Then they withdraw. Finally, British troops on nearby Copse Hill pour incendiary projectiles onto Charlestown and a cannon barrage. An eyewitness in Boston, spectators stood on crowded Boston roofs to glimpse this spectacle, the Battle of Bunker Hill, quote, "The sky was filled with the blaze of the burning town. Fire coursing through the whole streets or curling up the spires of public edifices. The air above filled with clouds of dense black smoke. That's an engraving there from Barnard's History of England. By 2:30 p.m., the ghost town is totally engulfed in fire. Pickett diverts 25% of his attacking force to flush out the remaining snipers, who had simply retreated to the burned-out shells of Charlestown structures and continually picked off British soldiers. As the colonials who were responsible for rescuing the precious artillery pieces fought to the very last man and were outnumbered in some cases 10-1 at the end of the melee, most of the fiercest fighting came from the infuriated men who watched their homes burn in Charlestown. It was the Charlestown guys that held out to the end. By the time the firestorm burns itself out, it had no place to go except the water, 380 dwellings were burned. Only 15 homes remained standing. British General Henry Clinton remarked in his diary that, quote, a few more such victories would have surely put an end to British dominion in America. Just some other depictions of that. Of course, that was the death of Dr. Joseph Warren, the leader. Boston Light, the destruction of Boston Light. Has anybody here been to Boston Light? It was closed last summer. If you get a chance, if it's open this summer, I highly recommend the trip. You'd love it. Take sandwiches. It's the first lighthouse built on the site, dates back to 1716. It's the first in the American colonies. And the current lighthouse dates back from 1783. It's the second oldest working lighthouse in the United States. The first keeper of the light was George Worthy Lake, who drowned along with his wife and daughter when returning to the island in 1718. Well, on June 1st, 1774, the Boston Port Bill, referred to by the colonists as the Intolerable Acts, went into effect, forbidding any cargo to be imported or exported from the port of Boston. The Battle of Bunker Hill took place on Breed's Hill on June 17th of that 1775, and Boston Light became part of the action. So in June 1774, the British occupied Boston, and the light passed into their hands. On July 20th and again on July 31st, the Americans dismantled the station and burned the wooden parts of the tower and buildings. The following perspective on the battle is recorded in Patriot Samuel Bixby's diary, dated 1775. August 1st. Yesterday, we had a fight with the regulars down at the lighthouse. We killed a considerable number of them and made prisoners of 35 regulars and 7 Tories. We burnt 2 schooners, 1 house, and 1 barn, and we sank a barge and took a great deal of plunder. Once the port of Boston was closed, the lighthouse served no use to the colonists. On July 20, 1775, a small troop of American soldiers under the leadership of Major Vos was diverted from a mission to harvest the grain in the town of Hull, thus preventing the British from doing so. They were sent out to Little Brewster Island, where their instructions were to destroy the wooden parts of the lighthouse, which they did by torching it after dismantling the light apparatus. Upon their return to Hull, they were fired upon by a British schooner. However, Vos's troops were able to outmaneuver the schooner and reach safety. An eyewitness in the siege of Boston said, quote, the flames of the lighthouse ascended up to heaven like grateful incense, and the ships wasted their powder. And in the summer of 1775, Major Benjamin Tupper, with a party of men, went from Milton and set fire to the lighthouse, which destroyed the woodwork and the glass. It was repaired by the British by order of Admiral Graves, who at that time commanded the British Navy. And then once more, he had the lamps relighted, which continued until June of 1776, when Captain Bangs, commander of the King of Ireland's ship Renown, of 50 guns, went to the island, took off the guard, left a quantity of powder, which took fire and blew up the building about an hour after his departure. So it was blown up by the British as they retreated. But if you get a chance, go out and see Boston Light. And again, the British blew it up when they evacuated from Boston. And then John Hancock, lower right-hand corner, said, now that the British have gone, on November 8, 1780, he was the governor of Massachusetts, and he reminded the Massachusetts legislature that the critical importance of a lighthouse, Boston being a port, we can expect the return of the days of good shipping. We need a lighthouse. Now, our home stretch here. Major fires of the American Revolution. The destruction of Falmouth. Although Falmouth, Massachusetts was actually attacked during the Revolution too and bombarded. This began when Royalist Captain Thomas Colson, a prominent Tory and businessman, asked for help as he was unable to land sails, rigging, and stores for a ship that he was attempting to outfit to sail with the fleet of Captain Henry Mowat in May of 1775. The Committee of Inspection refused to allow him to land anything and ordered his goods back be sent back to England. So he was being harassed. They knew that he was a loyalist. They weren't going to let him fix his ship. Captain Mowat then landed with the British sloop of war HMS Canso and assisted him in the outfitting of his ship in early April. When word reached Falmouth of the battles of Lexington and Concord, the Falmouth Minutemen began training on the neck and collecting and storing munitions. So they were ready for a fight. So in April of 1775, all of this marshaling of the Falmouth Minutemen was being observed by Captain Mowat on board his ship, the Canso. On April 24, 1775, after a special town meeting, people began moving their property out of Falmouth, which is modern-day Portland, as two other British ships came into Casco Bay. The next day, Thomas Smith said, quote, "We sent away to Wyndham our principal things. Our people are many of them doing the same." On May 7th, Colonel Samuel Thompson arrived with 50 men from Brunswick and hid in a grove of thick pine trees on the northern side of Munjoy Hill, overlooking Sandy Point. Their objective was to destroy Mowat's ship, the Canso. To their surprise, there's Captain Mowat taking a stroll with a preacher named Wiswell on Munjoy Hill. Thompson's men quickly seize him. Thompson, quote, "I thank Providence for throwing Mowat into my hands." And he marches his prisoners down into town into Marston's Tavern. Well, the second-in-command officer of the Canso ordered the release of Mowat, or he would lay the town to ashes. Thompson refused, saying, quote, "As it is open war between us, it is my duty and policy to retain my prisoners." The townspeople, meanwhile, some had already moved out fearing a British attack and raid, urged Thompson to release Mowat. Mowat promised, as an officer and a gentleman, to return if he was allowed one night's parole to his ship. Falmouth was short of supplies and provisions, and the citizens thought that this act would be a good show of faith and that the British would allow supply ships that are waiting outside the harbor to dock. A truce flag is raised, and Mowat is allowed to return to the Canso. He doesn't return the next morning, breaks his word. The next morning, Mowat fails to return and instead lands 600 troops. The town is now under British occupation and military law. The citizens then attack the homes of Tories, including Captain Colson's, which they turned into a barracks for the Minutemen. A drunken soldier by the name of Calvin Lombard then fired shots from a hill at the Canso. Meanwhile, Colson's boat, along with a British dory, was dragged through the streets in effigy. Local patriots captured several ships carrying supplies for Boston and weaponry from Fort Pownall at the mouth of the Penobscot River. An enraged Mowat ordered that Lombard be turned over to him and that these rebellious actions cease. Mowat heard of cannon, though, being placed clandestinely in the hills above Casco Bay, and fearing for his ship, he decides to leave the harbor with his fleet. The citizens of Falmouth were relieved, but on June 7th, the 16-gun sloop Senegal, along with Captain Colson and his new ship, sail into Casco Bay. When one of Colson's longboats sails up the Penobscot River in an effort to load masts, it's seized. Admiral Thomas Graves then issues orders in July of 1775 that Mowat carry on such operations upon the seacoasts as you shall judge most effective for suppressing the rebellion. Graves orders Mowat to lay waste, burn, and destroy such seaport towns as are accessible to His Majesty's ships, and particularly Machias, where HMS Margarita was taken. Mowat assembles a fleet of four ships, Canso, Symmetry, which was involved with Charlestown, Spitfire, and Halifax, and sails out of Boston Harbor on October 6, 1775. He opted against attacks on harbors in Cape Ann, where the buildings were too widely spaced for naval cannon fire to be effective. On October 16th, Mowat's fleet reaches the outer parts of Falmouth Harbor and anchors there. He sends one of his lieutenants ashore with a proclamation on October 17th, stating that he was there to, quote, "execute a just punishment for the town's state of rebellion." He gave the townspeople just 2 hours to evacuate. The townspeople sent a deputation to plead with Mowat for mercy. He promised to withhold fire if the town swore an oath of allegiance to King George. They must also surrender all their small arms and powder, along with their gun carriages. In response, the people of Falmouth began to move out of town. No oaths were sworn, a small number of muskets were surrendered, but no gun carriages. Moat had set a deadline of 9 a.m. on October 18th for the town's response. By 9:40 a.m., the town appeared to be deserted, so he ran a red flag up the Canso's masthead and ordered that the fleet begin firing on the town of Falmouth. Incendiary cannonballs set fire to the harbor installations and most of the town's houses and public buildings. One witness reported, quote, "The firing began from all the vessels with all possible briskness, discharging on all parts of the town, a horrible shower of balls from 3 to 9 pounds weight, bombs, carcasses, live shells, grape shot, and musket balls. The firing lasted with little cessation until 6 o'clock. It was kind of like a pirate voice, sorry. Moat then sent a landing party to set fire to any buildings that had survived. The town militia offered little significant resistance, as most were helping their families to safety. In spite of this, some of the landed British Marines were killed or wounded, and by evening, according to Moat, the body of the town was in one flame. Following the bombardment, Moat went on to Booth Bay, where he set fire to a few houses and raided for livestock, but his expedition was faltering to an end. The decks of some of his ships had been inadequately braced for prolonged gunnery, and many of his guns had jumped their mounts. By all this firing, he destroyed his own fleet. More than 400 buildings and houses were recorded as damaged or destroyed by fire in Falmouth. In his report to Graves, Moat stated that 11 small vessels were destroyed in the harbor itself and 4 captured at the cost of 1 man killed and 1 wounded. The people were left to fend for themselves till the winter. A visitor to the town of Falmouth reported that a month later there was no lodging, no eating, or housekeeping in Falmouth. So it wasn't really a success. Moat returns to Boston and remains there as the winter was setting in. When Admiral Graves was relieved in December 1775, these punitive raids were gradually abandoned. This action brought Maine into the Revolution full heart and soul, and funds were set up to deliver food and supplies to the starving residents of Falmouth. The Wallace bombardments quickly on August 30th, 1775. Royal Naval Captain James Wallace, commanding the HMS Rose, fires into the town of Stonington, Connecticut, after the townspeople there prevented Rose's tender from capturing a vessel it had chased into the harbor. There's a lot of privateering going on, by the way, by the colonists. They're stealing, they're raiding British shipping out and stealing its goods, bringing them back into harbor, imprisoning their crews. Apparently, not seeking to burn the town, he did not fire any heated rounds or incendiaries, although fires broke out. Wallace also fired on the town of Bristol, Rhode Island in October 1775 after its townspeople refused to deliver livestock to him, starting some fires. Burning of Norfolk. John Hancock writes to Colonel Bull on December 14, 1775, basically telling you to be ready. There's going to be some action in Norfolk, Virginia. How can I help you? Let me know. A few days after this letter's written, Virginian troops, aided by some nearby North Carolinians, defeated Lord Dunmore at Great Bridge and eliminated him as a threat to the colony. Dunmore did, however, burn Norfolk as he left, which made a great impression throughout America. Again, sparking more fervor in the revolution. This is Lord Dunmore. Norfolk, as you can see, port. Southeastern Virginia. Battle of Great Bridge. I won't go into the tactics here, but it was December 9, 1775, in an area of the Chesapeake. Lord Dunmore had been pillaging local villages, stealing from houses, setting houses on fire. At the time that this battle happened, it was called the Second Battle of Bunker Hill, and it resulted in the capture of Norfolk by the Patriots and the bombardment and complete destruction of Norfolk 3 weeks later on January 1, 1776. John Murray, the 4th Earl of Dunmore, Lord Dunmore, colonial governor of Virginia, had retreated from Williamsburg, but Norfolk was considered by the colonials to be a nest of Tories. Dunmore thought that he was making headway against the rebellion by pillaging the plantations of patriots, winning slaves over to his side, and seizing printing presses. With just one more regiment and a few more battalions, he wrote on November 30th, 1775, I really believe we should reduce this colony to a proper sense of their duty. On the other side, General George Washington urged that Dunmore should, quote, be instantly crushed, lest his forces grow. He wrote to the Continental Congress, "I do not mean to dictate. I am sure they will pardon me from freely giving them my opinion, which is that the fate of America is a good deal depends on his being obligated to evacuate Norfolk this winter or not." So Lord Dunmore, after feeding the opposition at Kemp's Landing, moves 10 miles south to Great Bridge on the Elizabeth River. Great Bridge was a shipping point, etc. So he finds the resistance increasing, so he builds a stockade on the north side, removes the bridge planking. That was a British tactic. Destroys five or six houses. And then comes Colonel William Woodford. He's in charge of the 2nd Virginia Regiment, and he's gathering forces at Great Bridge of Minutemen from Fauquier, Augusta, and Culpeper counties in the western part of the colony, as well as volunteers from Princess Anne and Norfolk counties. Woodford reported 250 Carolina men arriving under Colonel Vale, quote, "composed of regulars, minutemen, militia, and volunteers who had marched to Virginia from North Carolina on hearing of Lord Dunmore's insolences and outrages." So Dunmore is misinformed of the strength of the opposition, and he sends sailors from the HMS Otter, his ship, moored in Norfolk, plus some 60 townsmen on a surprise attack of Great Bridge, roughly 120 people. Outnumbered, they're ambushed, and they suffer 102 casualties to the colonists' one. A guy got a slight wound to a thumb. The colonists attended to the British wounded, and only 11 grenadiers survived and made it back to the Otter. So, on January 1st, 1776, by order of John Murray, Earl of Dunmore, Royal Governor of the Colony of Virginia, the British ships in Norfolk Harbor began shelling the town. They had heated shot and hollow shells containing live coals, carcasses, with the express purpose of burning the town to the ground. Most of Norfolk's inhabitants were loyalists, and they fled to the British ships that were in the harbor. Severe overcrowding soon led to the deaths from disease and starvation of the loyalists on the British ships. The occupying forces refused requests for provisions and were also taking pot shots at the ships. Dunmore announced that he would burn the town down on January 1, 1776, and shelling began at 4 o'clock in the morning. Landing parties helped the fires along, as did the occupiers. Remember, this town's actually a loyalist stronghold. So on January 1, 1776, the Norfolk sky turned flaming red and then cloudy with updrafts of blowing soot. A frigid wind carried a shower of burning coals inland from the waterfront, setting afire the roofs of more than 800 dwellings and buildings. When the flames finally burned out 2 days later, four-fifths of the once prosperous town lay in ashes. Before the end of February 1776, another 416 other structures were burned, leaving 6,000 homeless and inspiring a line in the Declaration of Independence. So the Virginia Assembly appointed a commission to find out what happened with the fire. And they found out that out of the 882 houses that were burned during those 2 days, only 19 had been set alight by the British. A further 416, in effect all that remained standing, were destroyed in February 1776 to prevent the British from using them as cover if they had returned. January 8th, 1776, just a little anecdote here. On January 8th, a performance of the British General John Burgoyne's farce, The Blockade of Boston, was ironically interrupted by the announcement that some American troops were conducting a raid. The audience mistakenly thought the announcement, made by an actor dressed in the uniform of a Continental Army sergeant, marked the opening of the play. The raid, led by Major Thomas Knowlton, succeeded in capturing five British prisoners and the burning of eight Loyalist houses. Knowlton's force did not suffer any casualties. And note, whenever I talk about Gentleman Johnny Burgoyne, I like to use pastel colors. In this case, I've chosen fuchsia. A couple more fires and we're done here. First Great Fire of New York, September 21st to September 22nd, 1776. George Washington wanted to attack and liberate New York. It was a Tory loyalist stronghold and had many prisons and prison ships full of Americans. It was also a strategic port. He also wanted to avenge the defeats that he had at Harlem Heights and Long Island. One of those retreats was the famous retreat in the fog, where he had dummy campfires so he could retreat in the fog and save the Continental Army. Well, Washington was talked out of attacking the city several times by his advisors. It would have meant sure defeat and the total destruction of the Continental Army. Some advisors suggested to him, hey, that if the city were burned, it's a Tory British stronghold. It would be destroyed. This would also deny a comfortable home to the British soldiers during the coming winter. So Washington evacuates New York on September 12, 1776. There's a famous engraving here of the Great Fire of New York. The Continental Army left the city intact and marched north to Harlem Heights at the opposite end of Manhattan Island, about 10 miles from the enemy. But on September 15th, just 3 days later, the British now occupy New York City. It's a British stronghold. On September 21st, a fire broke out in the Fighting Cock's Tavern just before 1 a.m. near Whitehall Slip. With the help of a strong wind, the fire quickly spread north. Strong winds quickly spread the flames among tightly packed homes and businesses. Around 2 a.m., a change in wind direction confined the fire to an area between Broadway Street and the Hudson River. Residents poured into the streets, clutching what possessions they could, and found refuge only on the grassy town commons. The fire raged into the daylight hours and eventually consumed 493 homes and buildings, about one-third of the city. The British accused the Americans of starting the fire. British troops had planned on using the houses in the area as billeting and stated that the Americans burned the city to prevent this from happening. British Army and Loyalist collaborators occupying the undamaged buildings for the remainder of the conflict, leaving the city's remaining residents in squalor during the Revolutionary War. There were stories of broken ladders during this fire, leather buckets with holes drilled in them, boarded up wells, and armed groups of men, some rebels, preventing firemen and Tories from getting to the scene of the fire, thus inhibiting their firefighting efforts and causing the city to burn. With the fire department in disarray and largely missing, the British soldiers attempted to extinguish the flames. Unable to quell the fire because of sabotaged equipment, the fire raged on from day into night. There are three separate fires over the course of September 20th through the 21st, 1776. Most of the city's volunteer firefighters evacuated the city to serve under George Washington's command, so only a skeletal fire department remained. And the colonists, as I mentioned, hit or sabotaged the fire engines, the fire pumps. They removed the fire bells and church bells, making it difficult to sound an alarm. Fire buckets lacked handles or the bottoms were slashed. Volunteer firefighters who tried to battle the blaze were also hindered and attacked by, believe it or not, British and Hessian soldiers. In fact, the brutality of the soldiers caused the death of colonist Peter Room. Nathan Hale was arrested in Queens for spying that very same day. Unsubstantiated rumors have since attempted to link him with the fires, but there's nothing indicated that he was arrested for anything more than espionage. Among the buildings destroyed was Trinity Church, New York. However, St. Paul's Chapel was to survive. And the fire is the reason why New York has only a few buildings that have been preserved since the American Revolution. And here's where it burned, part of Manhattan. Washington mused that some honest patriot might have helped him out by setting the fire. The British arrested 200 suspected sympathizers, and those citizens that were displaced by the fire set up canvas tents around the destroyed areas in Lower Manhattan. And just if you're wondering, there was a second great fire in New York, December 16th through the 17th, 1835, that consumed nearly 1,700 buildings. And then there was one in the 1840s, P.T. Barnum's building went up. Almost done, folks. The Great Charleston Fire. Charleston suffered so much with fires and earthquakes over the past hundreds of years. On January 15, 1778, a devastating blaze wiped out half the city, including the original Huguenot Church, 250 dwellings, stores, warehouses, and the Charleston Library Society, with over 6,000 precious, priceless volumes. The fire starts in a kitchen house at the corner of Union and Queen Streets, burns down toward Meeting Street, spreads down Union Street, east towards Broad, burns Elliott, Beaton's Alley, and Trad Street, east of Church Street. $3 million, that's 1778 dollars, and British loyalists are suspected. So here's one where the British now set the town on fire. In 1779, another huge fire destroyed much of the rebuilt city. This time, the colonials are suspected. So the Americans knew the importance of a canal in Charlestown. There was a battle there with General Clinton calling for an unconditional surrender from a Major General Benjamin Lincoln. But General Lincoln, who was a colonist, tried to negotiate for hours. Anyways, on May 11th, the British fired a red-hot shot that burned several homes before Lincoln finally called and negotiated surrender terms. That's in Charlestown. And then finally, what happened was that this defeat in Charlestown where Lincoln was defeated. It left no Continental Army in the South, and the country was wide open for the British taking. Even before Lincoln surrendered, the Continental Congress had already appointed Major General Horatio Gates to replace him. So with this fight, they lose Charleston for the rest of the Revolutionary War, and the British quickly established outposts in the outlying areas. But here's a gruesome one. This is the explosion of a powder magazine, May 1780. A powder magazine that sat between Archdale and Mazick, now Logan Streets, accidentally explodes. More than 200 people are killed, 60 that were burned beyond recognition. An eyewitness reported human limbs hanging from trees and torsos writhing on the street. A brothel was destroyed, and there were two other fires in Charleston in the 1700s. And they started a fire company in 1784. How much time do I have left, Michelle? What time is it?
It's
10 after 8. Okay, I'm going to wrap up here. New England's dark day. Basically, Friday, May 19, 1780. The sky goes dark. In fact, the week preceding the dark day of May 19, 1780, from Monday, May 15th through Thursday, May 18th, a hill in Melrose couldn't be seen from 2 miles away, and the sun seemed to be unusually red, spectacular sunsets, and the air had been very thick and heavy with smoke in some places. That's a depiction of preternatural darkness. I'll cut through some of these. Candles were lit in houses at midday, at noon. You could not see a person standing in front of you without a candle. Newspapers had to be read by candlelight. It bore at high noon, as if it were midnight. Kids were sent home from school. People flocked into the churches. They certainly thought that the end was near. And some people considered it as a portentous omen of the wrath of heaven and vengeance denounced against the land. Others as the immediate harbinger of the last day. And then still some others pointed to this as vengeance for the American Revolution. Everybody was familiar in those days with biblical scripture, so they knew about the end times. In Revelation 6:12, the sun became as black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood. Joel 2:31, the sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and terrible day of the Lord come. Yale President Timothy Dwight said, quote, "It was the general opinion that the day of judgment was at hand." When asked about the cause of the preternatural darkness, a New England minister retorted, quote, "I'm as much in the dark as you are." And there were several dark day sermon booklets printed and published the following days. Again, it was dark throughout the entire day. In fact, fowls went to roost and cocks crowed in answer to one another as they commonly do in the night. Frogs began to peep. So it was so dark at 11 o'clock in the morning that large print could not be read by persons of good eyes. And then this guy by the name of Viator, or Viator, shows up. And it's Latin for traveler. Well, he's a pub guy, okay? He likes to hang out in the pub. And he's well-educated, and he makes his own observations in Ipswich with other friends of his, general liberal education. And he notes that the hemisphere for several days have been generally obscured with smoke and vapor so that the sun and moon appeared unusually red. So the rising sun was red in color, and between 8 and 9 o'clock, he notes that the sun was quite shut in, and it began to shower. He thought that a powerful storm was approaching from the southwest, and while the sky churned and boiled at higher altitudes, nearly a blade of grass stirred at ground level. He deduced that this was not a thunderstorm coming. And suddenly they expected a violent gust of wind and rain, but it never came. So over the next several hours, he and his companions conducted experiments with candles and shadows of newsprint, and they all agreed that they could not read without the aid of a candle. By 1 o'clock, there was a glint of light, and then all of a sudden, a strange luminescence appeared in the west. I do an entire lecture, by the way, folks. It's an hour lecture on the dark day of New England. Just cutting to the chase here. The motion of the clouds in the western sky were now more quick than their color. There were quick flashes or coruscations, not unlike the aurora borealis, flashes of lightning. And then Viator perceives a strong sooty smell. And some of the company were confident that a chimney in the neighborhood must be burning. Others conjectured the smell was that of burnt leaves. So now he's floating a theory that the Viator thinks that the vast body of smoke from the woods, which had been burning for many days, mixing with the common exhalations from the earth and water, and condensed by the action of winds from opposite points, may be, perhaps be sufficient causes to produce the surprising darkness. He was right. There was also a blood moon. The clouds and smoke obscured the moon, and it made it look as if it were blood red, which fit nicely into end time scripture. And then Abraham Davenport, another wise man, he's in the legislature of Connecticut in session in Hartford. They want to adjourn the council, and Abraham Davenport says, "No, I am against an adjournment. The day of judgment is either approaching or it is not. If it is not, there is no cause for an adjournment. If it is, I choose to be found doing my duty. I wish, therefore, that my candles be brought in." So the cause? Well, from about May 1st in 1780, great tracts of forest along Lake Champlain down to Ticonderoga were set on fire. Okay. New settlers in the northern New Hampshire area along the Canadian border were also burning over forests to prepare them for cultivation. They selected the land to be cleared, as I mentioned in the opening remarks, and blazed the trees. Strong winds in March would knock down the trees. Well, some choppers, instead of waiting for spring, would fall the trees in a domino effect, and they'd start the fire early. Some of these piles of trees would be 20 feet high. And of course, there was a dry period in 1780, a severe dry period. You were coming out of a very hard winter, one of the hardest winters ever known in colonial times, the winter of 79-80. Very, very dry, bitterly cold. So this was kindling wood. This was timber ready to be ignited. So this is where they think the fire originated that caused New England's dark day. And again, due to the weather system, it held over Boston and held it in place with winds offshore blowing from the northeast, held it over the New England area, and they think that it started in Ontario. 1780 was also known as one of the greatest fire years ever recorded in North America until 1850. Fire dates based on tree rings and fire scars indicate that fires occurred in 1780 at several locations, so there could have been a convection of smoke clouds. The Algonquin Highlands of southern Ontario, western Maryland, western Virginia, the Ozarks, the Boston Mountains of Arkansas, and in northern Minnesota. So several fire history sites point to Algonquin Provincial Park as there's fire scar evidence of a major fire occurring there in 1780. So they think that that's where what was caused by the dark day. This was discovered about 10 years ago. They think it might have been started by dry lightning, but here's a neat one here. Do you see that arrow? There's the fire ring on a tree that shows that there was a major conflagration in the forests in Ontario in 1780. Quickly burning New London, this is it. this will just take 2 minutes. New London was a center of privateering efforts at harbored American pirates. And Benedict Arnold, who was a tremendous general, tremendous battle commander, for money reasons, defected in 1780 by deserting West Point. Well, on September 6, 1781, he led 800 regular British soldiers into the New London harbor at the mouth of the Thames River. A portion of the army went into the town. They met little resistance and commenced the destruction by fire of goods stockpiled in the waterfront warehouses. Arnold's plan was to delay and eventually destroy the ships from New London that were attempting to escape northward, which he did. And they're trying to move towards Norwich, which was the birthplace of Arnold. Norwich was up the river, the Thames River, from New London, and as Arnold calls out, he did not want to take his ships in there because he thought it would be a den of serpents and he'd never be heard of again. And there was 2,000 militiamen festering in the hills of Norwich. Anyways, the British fleet headed by Admiral Thomas Graves was anchored off of Long Island, and it basically the flotilla came off the coast of New London virtually unnoticed, and that was due to the fact that there were so many false alarms during that time, or that the seacoast guards were sound asleep and not enough were present. But warning was given, according to New London County's foremost expert on history, Francis Manwaring Cawkins, as it's believed that so many false alarms had sounded that the local militia never took notice. So the fleet closes in on the mouth of the Thames River around 9 a.m. By 10 a.m. on the 6th of September, 1781, the first of the transport boats land on the New London side about 3 miles from the center of town. The Brits land troops in dozens of transports, and at this landing, the alarm is now sounded from Fort Griswold, which consisted of two regular guns at fixed intervals. Boom, 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 boom. This was the signal to call in assistance from the neighboring countryside, while three guns was a signal of rejoicing, meaning that they had just brought in another pirate victory ship. So what happened was these signals had been communicated to the enemy. For when the two distress guns were fired, boom, boom, one of the large ships in the British fleet added a third, boom, so as to alter the importance of the alarm, so nobody would respond. Anyways, men and women sprang from their slumber. They tried to get whatever they could in their arms and their wagons and get out of town as the British just set fire to all sorts of buildings through New London. And you can see the red area, the burned out areas of New London. They took so much random fire that a British detachment fell into a house and began to throw out china, break the furniture, and ransack the house. They set it ablaze as it was suspected of housing some of those firing upon them. So the burning house, when they left, was saved by the local militia, who entered and poured some soap onto the flames to extinguish the fire. When Mr. Manwaring, who owned the house, returned to the house, he found a dying British soldier that was left for dead by the side of the road by his comrades, and he gave him water and contacted his parents by the promise after he died. So anyways, Arnold's men, they attacked Fort Trumbull. There are two forts there, Fort Griswold and Fort Trumbull. They attacked Fort Trumbull. The men flee Fort Trumbull and head to help out the fighting at Fort Griswold. There's casualties. The defenders at Fort Trumbull spike the cannons. That is, they fill them with cement or they destroy them. And then they row across the river. Some of the ships in the Thames, the rowboats of the American militia, are shelled by the British Navy. And just to close, and again, this
two slides to go here. This is where the British came in. This is where Norwich is. This is where Norwich is, New London. So this is where Arnold did not want to go, his birthplace, but he wanted to attack New London, which was a major pirate port.
Anyways, they set anything they could find on fire. Storage buildings, merchant shops, a mill, a mechanic shop, the courthouse, the jail, and eventually all the warehouses and wharf houses that are along the waterfront. Arnold points out his sword and yells, "Soldiers, do your duty!" And they set everything on fire. And then they find the Hannah, which was Sir Henry Clinton's prize ship. It was taken by pirates on the Minerva earlier in the summer, and the British were thinking about refitting it and returning it to Sir Henry Clinton. And then out of disgust, or maybe out of fear of rendezvous and militia who are now vectoring into the area, they just set it on fire and sent it adrift. And then the Battle of Fort Griswold, Arnold threw a spyglass at the ancient burial ground. "I immediately dispatched a boat with an officer to Lieutenant Colonel Eyre to countermand my first order to attack the fort, but the officer arrived a few minutes too late. Lieutenant Colonel Eyre had sent Captain Beckworth with a flag to demand a surrender of the fort, which was peremptorily refused, and the attack commenced." So, basically, they attacked the Fort Griswold. Colonel William Ledyard, portrayed here, he's the one staggering there on the right side. A valiant effort. He dismissed two orders to surrender. There were two assaults that he turned back, but when the third one came, he knew that he was done for and the situation was critical. So according to the American rendition of the events, the colonists, the Colonel Ledyard presented his sword as a token of surrender to a loyalist officer who accepted it and then promptly stuck him, ran him right through with his own sword. Those are the losses of New London. 65 private dwellings, 31 stores, 18 shops, 20 barns, 9 public buildings, an unknown number of sheds. 143 buildings burned to the ground, 97 families left homeless, 12 ships burned to the waterline, 4 were armed, unknown number of longboats, rowboats, and canoes, 50 cannon were destroyed on the shore, complete destruction of the wharves and warehouses, the casualties, militia suffered 6 dead and 12 wounded, as did the British, military losses may have been combined with those from the Groton Height attacks, and then 8 prisoners were taken. Civilians and unknown were taken away as prisoner, and then New London would again burn on September 21st, 1938, during the Great Hurricane of 38. And when urban renewal in the 1960s and 1970s leveled block after block in New London, Arnold was jokingly called the godfather of New London urban planning. This is just a volcano that erupted in 1783. My final slide. So my premise. The deliberate and barbaric burning of several colonial citizens by the British ignited the American Revolution and helped spark the Continental Army on to victory. Vengeance upon an attacking enemy incites a defender to fight for his home, his family, and his very being. The ability of the 13 colonies to endure fire sieges made them more resilient and resistant to British domination. That, my friends, is my talk. Thank you so much for your patience. Told you I was a hockey announcer. Hear me rattle through that, huh? Woo! Any questions? Well, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your time and your patience.